purpose of the wajibat and the compulsory deed is for self-building and for a person to reach a particular type of demeanor where he himself becomes the mirror of the attributes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So inshallah, until next time, my dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more.
Spotlight. Hello and a warm welcome to the first edition of Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Iran has been subjected to 4 decades of sanctions, and that pressure has helped Iranians to be self-reliant and creative. Now, the country which is facing sanctions, it has joined the little few countries in making its own COVID-19 vaccine. Not one, but several homemade jabs are being developed by the Islamic Republic of Iran.
The coronavirus pandemic continues to rage across the globe, causing more infections and deaths. A number of new variants have also added to the misery of those already hit hard by the deadly disease. To protect the people from the deadly virus, many countries have come up with mass vaccination programs. Iran has started using domestically produced vaccine in December last year. Earlier this month, authorities approved the use of Iran's flagship coronavirus vaccine called Coviran Barakat for a public inoculation program. That after the vaccine successfully passed all required tests, including the so-called Phase 3 human trials. Iran, a country of 80 million population, is also working on producing several other vaccines to inoculate its people against the pandemic. Iranian scientists have gone through nearly 1 year of intensive work to join the club of countries with the capacity to scale up production for coronavirus jabs.
By domestic vaccine, domestic production, in November we will go through the mass vaccination. And I think by considering the number of vaccination in each day, it will take 2 or 3 months for completion of the vaccination inside Iran.
On Friday, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, received the first dose of a Coviran Barakat vaccine. Ayatollah Khamenei thanked all those involved in producing it. The leader said there is nothing wrong with using a foreign vaccine along with the Iranian one. The Islamic Republic has been under tough economic sanctions by the U.S.-led West. That after former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled Washington out of the Iran nuclear deal. Trump then imposed what he called Washington's maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. European countries also followed suit. Now the sanctions not only target Iranian firms that have to do with energy and banking, they also hit pharmaceutical companies that's in violation of UN Charter.
The United States has maintained illegal sanctions against Iran and shown its animus towards the Iranian nation for decades. In the last 3 years, through its maximum pressure sanctions, not only has Iran lost up to $1 trillion in revenue, but Iranians have suffered and died as a result of this maximum pressure campaign, being denied critical medicines, especially at the height of a global pandemic.
All in all, what seems to be on the agenda for the U.S. and its European allies is the fact that their sanctions regime is targeting ordinary Iranian citizens who are facing one of the worst global health crises. That also brings to the spotlight the fact that despite all its human rights claims, the West is only seeking its own interests, even at the price of the lives of Iranian people.
Well, that was Mehdi Farman with that background report. Let's see which guests are joining us in tonight's Spotlight show. We'll have Senior Vice President for International Business Development in Tadbir Group, Ehsan Mohabbi, joining in the studio. And also, manager of the Coviran Barakat Vaccine Project, Dr. Hassan Jalili, will also be joining. guess, on Skype, I imagine. Now, let me start with our studio guest, Mr. Mohabi Kutabi, with us here.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. Now, let's see sanctions and how they have affected the Islamic Republic of Iran during this pandemic that has beset the whole world.
First of all, if I were to list all of the sanctions that the United States has imposed on us, I think it would be more numerous than all the sanctions that the United States has imposed on others.
Mm-hmm.
Well, terrorism is not just about the killing the innocent people in a country which, of course, the United States is an expert on it. We have more other types of terrorism, more dangerous, more inhuman.
Mm-hmm.
We call that economic terrorism. Economic terrorism in the coronavirus pandemic made serious limitations on Iran and affected the our people. Coronavirus ravaged the world, sparing no nation, and even, you know, in the largest economy in the world, also the United States, it considers itself a superpower. Needs other help from the other countries to fight against the coronavirus. I can remember the early days of the coronavirus in our country, and you know, the United States blocked all of our assets in other countries.
Right.
We couldn't buy a moral equipment, a hospital equipment, not even a ventilator or even a box of a mask.
Right.
And you know, they can remember very barbaric. You know, they cannot find that in the wild. You know, they are made a serious sanction on us. But also with that, those are heavy sanctions. They call that maximum pressure.
Maximum pressure.
We believe in ourselves. Mm. We activated our internal capacity. Believe in us, young scientists.
Mm-hmm.
And with this big achievement, this world's achievement, we joined the countries, six countries of vaccine creators.
In the world.
In the world.
Exactly. Okay. Let me now go to Dr. Jalali and ask him this question. Dr. Jalali, can you tell us about the various Iran-made vaccines and at which stage they are as we speak?
In the name of God, one of the vaccines that we have manufactured and is in the stage of mass production is Coviran Barakat vaccine that has received the emergency use authorization from the Health Ministry and has been placed in the country's vaccination basket. Speaking of the headquarters for executing the order of Imam Khomeini, there are other vaccines under trial. Some of them are in the preclinical trial stage, and the clinical studies will begin very soon. In the meantime, today, the joint product of Pasteur Institute of Iran and Cuba received the emergency use authorization from the Health Ministry. And this type of vaccine is a recombinant type. It received the authorization for use today. Currently, there are three or four platforms that has been going on by the private companies and the Razi Institute, and and these platforms are going through the clinical trial stages, and some of the other platforms are in the preclinical trial stage.
Now back to the studio. Mr. Mohabi, can you explain the type of challenges that Iranian scientists and doctors are facing? You mentioned the challenges in the early days. We couldn't even buy the simplest things among the PPE. Now, while trying to develop the vaccine, what were the challenges that Iranian scientists and physicians faced? The funny thing is that this is in comparison with those countries that impose crippling sanctions on Iran to prevent all of this from happening.
Well, the limitations that I mentioned before not stopped. It continued.
Mm.
And if I just wanted to look, if you know that our supreme leader, Ayatollah Imam Khamenei, had received the coronavirus vaccine, Iranian vaccine called Iran Barakat.
Mm-hmm.
I think it has a very important lesson for everyone, that you should reach the independence in all of the various subjects. You know, you tell about the limitations to me, and I wanted to tell you about the capacities we have.
Mm-hmm.
We have great scientists in Iran. I can tell you very clearly that I saw the Mr. Dr. Jalili and his co-workers working hard,
mm-hmm.
24 hours a day and all of the days of the week, hard working on for creating the coronavirus vaccine. And I think it's a very great achievement for the Islamic Republic and also the Islamic world. But you know, the United States had prevented all of the countries from having just a simple cooperation with us. They did not provide any technology for us, you know, to import some moral equipment, and also they prevent others to help us.
Mm-hmm.
They blocked our assets, but we didn't stop. We moved on, and we depended on our scientists, and I think it's a great resistance and
mm-hmm.
resistance that's also known as superpower and Indian faith.
And you did make an achievement.
Yeah.
Okay, let me put the same question, Dr. Jalili. Dr. Jalili, explain to us how Iran has been able to create all these vaccines despite all the limitations that your colleague also explained part of it here.
Well, the sanctions never stopped us, but they may have somehow slowed down the process. In order to have the quality test, we were in need of certain kits that did not exist inside the country, and we ran into difficulties, and we had difficulty obtaining those kits. In order to overcome such limitations, we had to manufacture these kits, and we did so. We studied the methods used for manufacturing the kits, and by making use of the health protocols, we developed those methods. Therefore, the sanctions did not stop us, but perhaps the sanctions slowed down the process. But there was another feature with regard to the sanctions. Despite the hardships that we had, we managed to produce many products domestically, and that developed our knowledge, and that led to the indigenizing the sciences in these fields. We had to actually acquire advanced knowledge, and in order to carry out the tests, we had to equip ourselves with advanced knowledge, and we did so. The production and development of vaccines brought about other achievements for the country as well. It deepened many applied scientific disciplines and developed them.
Okay, back to the studio. Mr. Mohepi, what do you make of the global response to the pandemic and the fact that the majority of the vaccines have been given to wealthier countries?
Look, fighting against the coronavirus and any other pandemic requires pragmatism, not a speech.
Mm.
It's very easy for some countries, some also consider itself as a superpower in group of seven. They said that we provide 1 billion vaccines for poor countries. But it's just a simple showing off, you know, it's a hoax. You should ask the African people, that have you ever received just a single dose of the vaccine? Look, we planned our vision to provide life for all of them.
Right.
Look, I just wanted to quote a poem from the Rumi. It's so that, say not all are fighting, what is my lone call for peace? You are not alone, but thousands light your beacon.
Mm.
And I think that we cannot leave other countries alone. You can't have a safe country when there is only an even unsafe country. If you want to remove this pandemic from all across the world, you should fight against that coronavirus in all of the countries.
Right.
At all.
Okay. Now let me ask Dr. Jalili, you know, with this type of vaccination apartheid that we are facing in the world, will it take the world longer to bring the virus under control? Because there are many variants, and we have this Delta variant recently. So what about the response? Will it be equal and simultaneous?
Regarding the fact that some wealthy countries have received a major portion of vaccines and many other countries still do not have the ability to vaccinate even a small portion of their populations, that's not an appropriate solution for countering this pandemic. Allow me to explain this to you, something that the whole world is facing. You see that wealthy states have vaccinated a major portion of their populations, but there's a variant that was mutated in India and expanded to and was spread actually to other countries. And you see that countries where a major portion of the population has been vaccinated, they are again facing the spread of the coronavirus. Today, Britain is again facing the spread of the coronavirus. The Zionist regime is facing an escalating trend of the spread of the virus. The same is true about the United States. So if the world decides to counter this pandemic, all world countries must be, the populations in all world countries must be vaccinated. Otherwise, there's going to be more variants, and there's going to be new variants emerging in other countries. So if a vaccine is produced, it must be provided to all people, and sufficient amount of the vaccine must be produced so that the whole world would get rid of this malicious virus.
When you review the global response to this pandemic, what would you say are some of the main lessons that have been learned, especially for the countries such as Iran?
I think that the main lesson, if I want to summarize that, is that it's that don't ever, ever give up. It's not an easy way. We should go on and even think about the limitations, and you should believe in yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It's the most important point in this achievement of Iran. You should believe in yourself. I already mentioned that the United States and all of the many countries, they didn't let us to have the technology. They didn't let us to have a cooperation. They didn't let us to have access to some scientific journals. They didn't let us. And the main lesson that I think that our Supreme Leader taught to many countries is that you should believe in yourself and try hard to achieve this vaccine. And I wanted to mention Dr. Jalili's quote his speech, that we won't leave the other countries alone, but any good actions should be done in right time.
Right.
And I think that with this vaccine we provide for our Ministry of Health and the vaccination of our people, they can provide for other countries as soon as possible.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments. So let me thank our guests. We had Senior Vice President for International Business Development in Tadbia Group, Ehsan Mohebi, joined in the studio. And also we had the manager of COVID-19 Barakat Vaccine Project, Dr. Hassan Jalili, also joined us online. I've been your host, Andrew Najaf, and I'll see you next time.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, traits of true believers. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. We have many traits that are to be found in true believers. And today we're going to discuss a few of them so we can learn from these traits and ponder and think how we can establish and develop these traits in our everyday lives. True believers live with humility. They're never boastful of their possessions or achievements, nor do they look down on others. There is no air of superiority in their demeanor. They are totally free of arrogance and the delusion of self-importance. Whenever they see people involved in vain or useless talk, they pass by with dignity without getting involved. Similarly, if someone jeers at them or tries to disengage them from the right path, they simply reply with a greeting of peace and move on. They consciously avoid indulging in backbiting. See, when Quran and Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wassalam talk about the believers, these are some of the traits that are expected to be built into the personalities of these believers. Let it be men or women, old or young, all of you. If we are lacking these traits, then according to the definition of Islam and Prophet and Ahlul Bayt, we're not believers, unfortunately. Now look at backbiting, for instance, this one thing that we mentioned in the last. How easily do we go around and backbite other people as if we're not doing anything wrong? This is not how it's supposed to be, brothers and sisters. We have to be careful in our everyday lives. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are talking about some of the traits of true believers. And yes, we all yearn to be true believers. But for that, we have to establish these traits in our everyday lives. True believers keep themselves chaste and are always on ground and on guard against immodesty and all forms of obscenities. They also have a high regard for physical cleanliness as ordained by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, knowing that He loves those who purify themselves, as chapter 2, verse number 222 proclaims. So brothers and sisters, this spiritual cleanliness and the physical cleanliness, both of them are of utmost importance for believers. Sometimes we think, you know, it suffices to be physically clean, but spiritually we have contaminated thoughts, contaminated soul, contaminated spirit, and we think it's okay to be like that. And then there's the flip side of the coin, and that is that our soul is clean. We're trying to do different things through supplications, through prayers, through visiting the shrines of Ahlul Bayt. But when it comes to our physical well-being and physical maintenance, we're not paying the due attention. Brothers and sisters, for a believer, in order for that person to be a believer, he or she has to be physically and spiritually clean and pure. The believers eat what is clean and wholesome, taking care to refrain from what Allah has prohibited. They ensure what they eat is already earned lawfully. Hence, they avoid earning income through bribery or fraud and means involving usury or gambling. Listeners of IRIB English Radio,
Thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
The World with Reporters.
Britain has a new man in charge of the country's health service. Former Chancellor Sajid Javid replaces Matt Hancock to helm the most under-pressure department in government. First point of order, attempting to manage the COVID crisis.
I want to see the restrictions lifted and life going back to normal as quickly as possible. And that's at my right here and now, that is my absolute priority.
But this is no ordinary cabinet reshuffle. Previous Health Minister Matt Hancock was forced to step down after embarrassing revelations about his private conduct were made public.
I understand the enormous sacrifices that everybody in this country has made, that you have made, and those of us who make these rules have got to stick by them, and that's why I've got to resign.
Despite presiding over the shambolic handling of Britain's COVID response, it became clear that Hancock had fallen out of favour inside Downing Street.
I think it's really likely he was pushed. The exact provenance of the CCTV footage from within his office is not clear, but it's clear that it would be very hard to access that if you weren't in some way strongly connected to the government. So if Boris didn't want him to go, someone did very much. Quite clear that his position was no longer tenable.
For those hoping there'd be a change in approach from the new health chief, they may well be disappointed.
There is no ideological difference between Sajid Javid and Matt Hancock. It's a new face, just as Jeremy Hunt. Jeremy Hunt became an absolutely figure of hate while he was presiding over the NHS, precisely because he was implementing these ongoing privatisation policies. We're living with the consequences of the NHS being driven into the ground. We've seen unprecedented, really corruption, giving away, gifting tens and hundreds of billions during this pandemic. Sajid Javid, I have no doubt, will continue in the same line.
Britain's National Health Service was already creaking at the seams even before the pandemic. And for the millions who've been waiting to see a medical professional, well, they won't mind who is in charge of the health service. They just want to be made better, and made better soon. With COVID dominating the health agenda, Sajid Javid will have his work cut out for him. And as the fate of his two predecessors has shown, landing the top job is the easy part. Mina Taylor, London.
rights activists, along with families of terror victims in Iran, attended this gathering in Tehran to mark the American Human Rights Week. The annual occasion aims to shed light on the U.S.'s record of rights violations in Iran.
We're marking the American Human Rights Week to review the numerous cases where the U.S. openly violated human rights in our country, like the American Navy's downing of our passenger plane in 1988, after which the perpetrators received a badge of honor in the U.S. The latest crime the U.S. has committed was to assassinate the spearhead of the fight against terrorism, General Qasem Soleimani.
The second day of the week-long occasion marks the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of the Iran Islamic Republic Party in Tehran by the U.S.-backed Mujahideen-e-Khalq terror organization, known as the MKO. 73 leading officials of the Islamic Republic were killed, including former Justice Chief Ayatollah Muhammad Ali Beheshti.
Iran says it has lost over 17,000 people in terrorist attacks. 12,000 of them were killed at the hands of the formidable MKO terrorist group. What's even more shocking is that the U.S. does not regard the MKO as a terrorist entity and has even established intimate ties with them.
The U.S. and Europe delisted the MKO as a terrorist organization. Following this measure, the group was relocated from its former stronghold at a U.S. military base in Iraq to Albania and France. Ever since, the MKO has held regular meetings with American and European officials.
Members of U.S. Congress regularly meet MKO leaders where they offer any kind of support to the terrorist group. The U.S. is still supporting the terrorists in their anti-Iran campaigns. The MKO killed our top nuclear scientists, and that was not possible without the U.S. and Israel's assistance.
I lost my husband in the 1981 bombing of the Islamic Republic Central Office by the MKO. Interestingly, the spearhead of the terrorist operation, whose real name is Ali Mohtamed, took refuge in the Netherlands, and they welcomed him until a few years ago when the MKO disposed of him as a lost cause.
The American Human Rights Week started on June 27th, which marks the anniversary of the failed assassination of the then Iranian president Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei by the MKO terrorists in 1981, and will end on July the 3rd, which coincides with the anniversary of the U.S. Navy's shooting down of an Iranian passenger plane in 1988. Organizers of the occasion say the ultimate goal of the week-long ceremonies is to expose the U.S.'s double standards when it comes to the issue of human rights. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Traders and exporters of agricultural crops held a demonstration in front of the United Nations headquarters in Gaza to deliver their representative of the United Nations a protest letter against new restrictions imposed by Israel to export Palestinian agricultural crops like vegetables. Israeli closure of borders has led to a huge damage in the agricultural sector of the Gaza Strip.
We have come here to protest against Israeli closure of borders. We want to sell our products in the West Bank and other parts of the world. Israel intends to ruin our lives by adopting such restrictive measures. We call on all human rights organizations to do something.
Palestinian farmers are facing serious financial losses due to the Israeli closure of borders. This is viewed in Gaza as part of a larger plan by Israel to destroy Palestinian economy. Palestinian farmers called on the international community to be committed to its responsibilities and pressurize Israel into opening the borders.
Israel's new restrictive measures will ruin our crops before they reach the target markets. All of our vegetables are stuck here and eventually destroyed. I'm standing here to protest these restrictions that have made our lives unbearable. We demand opening of the borders so we can export our products. This blockade is inhumane.
Along with the Israeli ban on export, the latest aggression on the Gaza Strip has doubled the damage in agricultural sector. This has led to severe losses in this sector as Palestinian farmers can barely afford the living.
Our message to the United Nations is that Israel's measures are aimed to deteriorate life of all Palestinian farmers and traders. The latest Israeli aggression has inflicted a heavy blow on the agricultural sector. Israeli restrictions have no purpose but to ruin agricultural sector of Gaza.
Due to the Israeli ban on the exportation of goods, the prices for agricultural products in Gaza have dropped significantly. Palestinian farmers and traders here say that the Israeli restrictions imposed on exporting crops aim to destroy the Palestinian economy. They call on the international community to end these restrictions and open the borders. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Demonstrations against Palestinian Authority over the death of Nizar Banat, an activist and outspoken critic of the PA, keep going on across the occupied West Bank. In the city of Ramallah, these protests turned violent as the protesters who began to march to presidential compound faced a group of PA president security officers in plain clothes. The forces blocked the rally, chased and attacked the protesters who were chanting slogans against the PA and its president. Palestinian security forces in riot gear fired tear gas and stun grenades to disperse the protesters. Palestinian factions condemned the use of force against the protesters, saying people have the right to peacefully protest.
The people see that the investigation is slow and that the Palestinian Authority has not yet condemned the killing of Nizar Banat. So people are taking to the streets to ensure those behind Banat's death are put on trial.
Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Ishtayi said an investigation was launched to investigate Banat's death. Palestinians are demanding a swift, independent, and a transparent investigation. Palestinian rights group made an initial autopsy, saying that Banat took blows to the head, and the wounds indicated an unnatural death.
We need to take some practical steps within law that require justice, investigation, and accountability for those behind Nizar Banat's death. We say there is a need to dismiss this government as well as the heads of the security forces.
Journalists were also attacked by security forces during the protests. The Palestinian journalist CNN decried the grave development in the attack on freedom of expression and the media. Journalists, meanwhile, say condemnation is not enough. They say the attack is unacceptable and should be investigated in order to hold those responsible accountable.
Commentators say that what's going on today is only the tip of the iceberg. They say if the Palestinian Authority wants to prevent a possible collapse, it should bring those perpetrators into justice and allow people to freely protest and express their opinion. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
And armed conflict in Yemen 2021 was the title of the recent report of the Secretary General of the United Nations. In a press conference held by Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights, Yemen government discussed the UN report and how children protection could be achieved.
For years now, we have been used to see the United Nations doing the opposite of what it should do regarding the crimes of the Saudi-led coalition. This report in itself is considered a war crime against the children of Yemen. It was clear from the first day of the war in Yemen that the United Nations seeks to legitimize war and crimes.
The ministry said the report of the United Nations is full of inaccuracies and doesn't rely on any investigation on the ground, adding that the report aims to legitimize the Saudi war crimes against Yemeni children.
The most serious inaccuracy in the recent United Nations report is that it zeroed the number of crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition countries and did not mention any of their crimes. Unfortunately, the United Nations accused the Yemeni army of targeting more than 7,000 children, and these numbers are incorrect. The United Nations didn't explain where it has got these statistics from.
Saudi Arabia, backed by Washington, launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015. During the war years, Riyadh has committed numerous violations of international law, including using internationally prohibited weapons in its air raids, which have killed tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children.
Besides the ongoing Saudi siege that prevents millions of Yemenis, including children, from getting food, medicine and fuel, Saudi airstrikes have also killed more than 4,000 Yemeni children alone, according to rights organizations. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana.
Demonstrations against Palestinian Authority over the death of Nizar Banat, an activist and outspoken critic of the PA, keep going on across the occupied West Bank. In the city of Ramallah, these protests turned violent as the protesters who began to march to presidential compound faced a group of PA president's security officers in plain clothes. The forces blocked the rally, chased and attacked the protesters who were chanting slogans against the PA and its president. Palestinian security forces in riot gear fired tear gas and stun grenades to disperse the protesters. Palestinian factions condemned the use of force against the protesters, saying people have the right to peacefully protest.
The people see that the investigation is slow and that the Palestinian Authority has not yet condemned the killing of Nizar Banat. So people are taking to the streets to ensure those behind Banat's death are put on trial.
Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Ishtayi said an investigation was launched to investigate Banat's death. Palestinians are demanding a swift, independent, and a transparent investigation. Palestinian rights group made an initial autopsy, saying that Banat took blows to the head, and the wounds indicated an unnatural death.
We need to take some practical steps within law that require justice, investigation and accountability for those behind Nizar Banat's death. We say there is a need to dismiss this government as well as the heads of the security forces.
Journalists were also attacked by security forces during the protests. The Palestinian Journalists Union decried the grave development in the attack on freedom of expression and the media. Journalists, meanwhile, say condemnation is not enough. They say the attack is unacceptable and should be investigated in order to hold those responsible accountable. Commentators say that what's going on today is only the tip of the iceberg. They say if the Palestinian Authority wants to prevent a possible collapse, it should bring those perpetrators into justice and allow people to freely protest and express their opinion. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
On June 25, 1950, the Korean War broke out as the North Korean army poured across the 38th parallel into South Korea. The anniversary Friday provided a marker for reflection. The war memorial here in the center of the South Korean capital is part of ongoing multifaceted efforts to promote the military. Here, honoring those who served and died in the Korean War, South Koreans, Americans, and other nationalities. But the 1950 to 53 conflict was only suspended with an armistice, not a peace treaty. And because of the tension with North Korea, South Korea requires all able-bodied men to serve a year and a half in the armed forces. More and more South Koreans are not buying into the rhetoric of militaristic antagonism. Activist Shin Jae-uk this week launched an online museum, a group effort exposing disturbing aspects of the Korean War with previously restricted material.
The War Memorial Hall was established in the name of patriotism education to extol anti-communist ideology. It is centered on generals and heroes, not ordinary soldiers or civilians, and is belligerent about war and glorifies it.
Documents in the exhibit confirm the U.S. military's use of napalm in the Korean War and suspicions that a South Korean general destroyed a bridge across the Han River, preventing thousands of civilians from retreating.
This exhibit is about the stories of people who are hidden behind the ideology that national security is most important. It comes from the perspective of war victims. We want to let people know that war is not allowed, and there is no just war in the world. And when war breaks out, people are forced to die this way.
Some 2.3 million people were killed during the Korean War, often called the Forgotten War or the Never-Ending War. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The
month of the year on the Iranian calendar marks a series of tragic events that occurred during the early years of the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. From the U.S. Army's shooting down of an Iranian airliner in 1988 to the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of the Iran Islamic Republic Party in Tehran by the U.S.-backed Mujahideen-e-Khalq terror group are examples of the incidents that fall in the same time frame, between late June and early July.
The U.S. footprints can be traced in almost all of the incidents that occurred during this period. The events were so harsh and fateful that are still remembered by Iranians after decades. Every year, Iran marks June the 26th to July the 2nd as the week of American human rights. As a jab, that questions the U.S. standing as rights advocate.
The week-long occasion is associated with nationwide ceremonies. Each day commemorates one of the incidents. The first day marks the attempted assassination of the then-president Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei by the MKO terrorists in 1981. The second day marks the bombing of the headquarters of the Iran Islamic Republic Party in Tehran in the same year. 73 leading officials of the Islamic Republic were killed, including former Justice Chief Ayatollah Muhammad Ali Beheshti. The event is known in Iran as the 7th of Tir disaster. This incident was also carried out by the MKO terror group. In 2012, the United States removed the MKO from the list of terrorist organizations, something which is interpreted as Washington's dual take on terrorism.
The United States' hostility toward Iran became more evident after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. It supported Iraq's Saddam Hussein in his war against Iran, and also funded and supported the MKO terrorists in numerous attacks on Iranian people. So we reviewed these incidents during this week to let the world know that the U.S. is not a defender of human rights.
The week also marks Iraq's 1987 chemical attack on the city of Sardasht in West Azerbaijan province during the eighth-year Iraqi-imposed war on Iran. At least 110 people were killed, and 5,000 more were injured in the attack, which was carried out using chemical weapons provided by the U.S. and some other Western countries.
The chemical bombardment of Sardasht was one of the most heinous crimes against humanity. Sardasht was the third city after Japan's Hiroshima and Nagasaki to become the target of weapons of mass destruction. Former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein possessed a huge arsenal of chemical weapons, which were produced using materials supplied by the U.S. and other Western countries.
Observers say Washington portrays itself as the defender of human rights across the globe, but it uses the issue as an excuse to exert pressure on other countries, while closing its eyes on its own rights violations. Organizers hope the week-long ceremonies will help shine a light on the U.S.'s double standards when it comes to the issue of human rights. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Former U.S. police officer Derek Chauvin has been sentenced to 22 and a half years in prison for the murder of African-American George Floyd during an arrest in May 2020 in the city of Minneapolis. This came after a jury found 45-year-old Chauvin guilty on April 20th of unintentional second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter. President Joe Biden reacted to the court's decision, saying the prison sentence seemed to be appropriate. But civil rights activists, as well as members of Floyd's family, had a different point of view.
This sentencing is the longest sentence we've seen, but it is not justice, because George Floyd is in a grave tonight, even though Chauvin will be in jail.
When you think about George being murdered in cold blood with a knee on his neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds, execution style in broad daylight, 22 and a half years is not enough.
This right here is this 22-year sentence they gave this man. It's a slap on the wrist. We serving a life sentence of not having them in our life, and that hurts me to death.
We didn't get what we wanted. We definitely wanted to see the maximum penalty, but however, as they've already stated, we do have the federal ahead of us.
Experts say Chauvin's trial was a stunt to distract African Americans from their main demands.
I think what we're seeing here is more bait and switch and distraction. When they focus, and the media is complicit in this, the U.S. corporate media, because what they do when they focus on trials like this, they're trying to distract what the ultimate goal and the primary goal of the movements, the uprisings are.
The video of the white officer kneeling on the neck of the unarmed black man in handcuffs for more than 9 minutes sparked outrage in the U.S. and around the world. However, Floyd was just one of thousands of black victims murdered by U.S. police. According to research and advocacy group Mapping Police Violence, nearly 7,800 people were killed by police in the United States from 2013 to 2020. A disproportionate number of victims were African Americans. The group says black Americans are 2.5 times as likely to be killed by police as white people. Meanwhile, inspired by the verdict in George Floyd's case, relatives of other police brutality victims in the U.S. have also come forward demanding their cases reopened. But as many see the recent court ruling against the murderer of Floyd far from proportional to the crime he has committed, justice in the U.S. society seems to remain as elusive as ever.
In Chifornac, a Yupik village near the western coast of Alaska, the water is getting closer. The thick ground, once frozen solid, is thawing. The village preschool, its blue paint peeling, sits precariously on wooden stilts in spongy marsh between a river and a creek. Storms are growing stronger. At high tide these days, water rises under the building, sometimes keeping out the children aged 3 to 5. The shifting ground has warped the floor, making it hard to close the doors, and mold is growing. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Christopher Falavelle and Kaylin Goodluck. The piece is titled, Dispossessed Again, Climate Change Hits Native Americans Especially Hard. Chifornac, a Yupik village near the western coast of Alaska, the water is getting closer. The thick ground, once frozen solid, is thawing. The village preschool, its blue paint peeling, sits precariously on wooden stilts in spongy marsh between a river and a creek. Storms are growing stronger. At high tide these days, water rises under the building, sometimes keeping out the children aged 3 to 5. The shifting ground has warped the floor, making it hard to close the doors, and mold is growing. I love our building, said Eliza Tunichuk, one of the teachers. At the same time, I want to move from here. The village, where the median income is about $11,000 a year, sought help from the federal government to build a new school on dry land, one of dozens of buildings in Chifornac that must be relocated. But agency after agency offered variations on the same response. No. From Alaska to Florida, Native Americans are facing severe climate challenges, the newest threat in the history of Native Americans marked by centuries of distress and dislocation. While other communities struggle on a warming planet, Native American tribes are experiencing an environmental peril exacerbated by policies, first imposed by white settlers and later by the United States government, that forced them onto the country's least desirable lands. And now, climate change is quickly making that marginal land uninhabitable. The first Americans face the loss of home once again. In the Pacific Northwest, coastal erosion and storms are eating away at tribal land, forcing Native American communities to try to move inland. In the Southwest, severe drought means the Navajo Nation is running out of drinking water. At the edge of the Ozarks, heirloom crops are becoming harder to grow, threatening to disconnect the Cherokee from their heritage. Compounding the damage from his past decisions, The U.S. federal government has continued to neglect Native American communities, where substandard housing and infrastructure make it harder to cope with climate shocks. The federal government is also less likely to help Native communities recover from extreme weather or help protect them against future calamities, according to a New York Times review of government data. Interviews with officials, members, and advisors at 15 federally recognized tribes portray a gathering climate crisis and a test of the country's renewed focus on racial equity and environmental justice. Many tribes have been working to meet the challenges posed by the changing climate, and they have expressed hope that their concerns would be addressed by President Joe Biden, who has committed to repairing the relationship with tribal nations and appointed Deb Haaland, the first indigenous cabinet secretary, to run the Interior Department. But Joe Biden has announced few specific policies or actions to directly reduce